You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the August 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's this month's cover story, Kendrick Ascendant, on tour with the Pulitzer Prize-winning King of Rap by Lisa Robinson. Photographs by Annie Leibovitz. Opening photo, Kendrick Lamar, photographed on stage at Jones Beach Theater in Wantagh, New York, May 30th. Kendrick Lamar understands and employs blues, jazz, and soul in his music, which makes it startling. His work is more than merely brilliant, it is magic, said Toni Morrison. It takes guts, courage, and skill to shoulder the burden of a generation's mindset. Culturally, Kendrick Lamar is that compass, in fact, a GPS, in this current hour of chaos. That enough is worth a Pulitzer Prize or any award that sets the bar high, said Chuck D. I love everything about his music. I can literally listen to his music and become a kid, growing up with all the struggles in the inner city, but at the same time learn all the lessons it taught that we use as men today. If you listen to the last verse of Black Boy Fly on Good Kid, Mad City, I know exactly what he means, because I was that kid, said LeBron James. The minute I hear good news, it just motivates me to do more. I don't want to get complacent. If you ask 7 out of 10 people, what would you do if you got the Pulitzer Prize? They'd say, I'd put my feet up. But that would make me feel I'd reached my pinnacle at 30 years old, and that wouldn't make me feel good, said Kendrick Lamar. Memorial Day, Peter Luger Steakhouse, Brooklyn. Kendrick Lamar orders salmon. He is wearing a black baseball cap, white t-shirt, and gray and blue pants. And I'm seated to his right at an upstairs table for 10. To my right is Kendrick's TDE, Top Dog Entertainment label mate, rapper, and friend J-Rock. And the rest of our lunch party is comprised of friends and associates of Kendrick's. Dave Free, his friend since 9th grade, manager, co-director of their groundbreaking videos, and TDE president. Dave's assistant, Keaton Smith. Kendrick's assistant, Derek McCall. Photographer, videographer, Chris Parsons. Head of TDE Security, 2T's, TDE General Manager, Rhett One, and publicist, Ray Alba. Except for Kendrick's fish choice, everyone else orders cheeseburgers and steak, medium rare. Platters of French fries and creamed spinach are brought to the table. Despite people sitting at tables all around us, we are left alone. Kendrick, who has a reputation as enigmatic and shy, warms up as we talk about music, basketball, government, taxes, other rappers, and awards. I tell them that LeBron James wore a TDE t-shirt at practice the day before, prior to Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals. We talk about Madison Square Garden, where the following night, Kendrick will perform his first sold-out headlining show at the world's most famous arena as part of the 30-date TDE Championship Tour with a lineup of the label's artist. We talk about the changes in Harlem, the changes in Brooklyn, and how New York is no longer the city that never sleeps. There is a wide-ranging conversation about the music Kendrick grew up listening to in Compton, California. The Temptations, he was named for lead singer Eddie Kendricks, Curtis Mayfield, Marvin Gaye, Michael Jackson, and gangsta rap, and I answer queries about my interviews of yesteryear. I tell Kendrick, to forget about the three times he was nominated for the Best Album Grammy and didn't win, although I didn't say it quite so politely, and congratulate him on winning the Pulitzer Prize, the first for a non-classical or non-jazz musician, and the first for a rapper. Kendrick always appears to be thinking or listening until he breaks into a gap-toothed grin or a laugh. These guys know each other well, especially Dave and Kendrick, who finish each other's sentences, and the vernacular is unfiltered, rooted in hip-hop and the streets of Compton. Following lunch, we all get into a Mercedes Sprinter, stopping at a pop-up store on Hudson Street in Manhattan that sells a clothing collaboration between TDE and Nike, with whom Kendrick also has a shoe deal. Then we head uptown to an East Side hotel, where he and I sit and talk for over an hour. In addition to winning this year's Pulitzer Prize for music, Kendrick Lamar has sold more than 17.8 million albums, been nominated for 29 Grammys, and won 12. His work is archived in the library at Harvard University. He's been described as the poet laureate of hip-hop, perceptive, philosophical, unapologetic, fearless, and an innovative storyteller whose body of work has been compared to James Joyce and James Baldwin. He's collaborated with, among many others, Jay-Z, Eminem, Dr. Dre, Beyoncé, Rihanna, Bono, Pharrell Williams, J-Rock, and Maroon 5. He writes about being young, black, poor, and gifted in America, with a candid self-awareness of who he is, where he's from, and where he's been. Musician-producer Pharrell, who worked with Kendrick on the songs Good Kid and All Right, had told me he's the Bob Dylan, the Miles Davis of our time, but he's his own thing. His ability to entertain while educating, without ever being preachy, is amazing. I ask Kendrick how he balances his enormous success and celebrity with his extreme work ethic. You can get put in an environment that can bring down your integrity and your fight, he says. What gives me an advantage in my upbringing is the duality of seeing one of the most beautiful moments of me being 6 years old to the most tragic moment of being 13 or 14, and make that connection so the person listening can really see the conflict. It was a mind F, for sure. I would wake up one morning and it would be cartoons and cereal, and walking back from school. And at 4 p.m., we'd be having a house party till 11 p.m., and people were shooting each other outside the door. That was my lifestyle, and it's not only mine, it's so many other individuals, and I wanted to tell that story. By the end of listening to his first full album, I felt like I knew everything about him. He brings you into his world with his lyrics in a way that really paints a clear picture, said Eminem. Among other individuals to whom his story resonates are the NBA basketball players who grew up either in Compton or similar Los Angeles neighborhoods. According to Orlando Magic forward Aaron Aflalo, name-checked in Kendrick's song, Black Boy Fly, I used to be jealous of Aaron Aflalo. If you're in Compton with all that negativity and violence, and you know you have the talent that Kendrick obviously has, and you watch someone that's successful, I don't think jealous is a negative word. It's something that made him hungry. He knew what he could become. Next photos, Lamar before the Jones Beach show. J-Rock, producer Hakeem Carter, and security director Tootees backstage. And Lamar in a 1985 Buick LeSabre outside the New York Expo Center in the Bronx. Toronto Raptors all-star DeMar DeRozan, who grew up near Kendrick, says, "Everything he raps about is what we had to overcome and grow through." And Oklahoma City Thunder all-star point guard Russell Westbrook adds, He grew up in the same neighborhoods I grew up in, and to see him be able to explain the struggles of his upbringing through his music is inspirational. He's opening people's eyes to what people go through in the inner city. For a gentle dude, he throws a righteous punch. I wouldn't get in the way of it. No single artist will ever be the antidote to a generation's malaise, but just identifying some of the problems really helps, says Bono. Kendrick Lamar Duckworth was born in Compton 31 years ago to Paula Oliver and Kenny Duckworth, and is the oldest of four siblings. He started freestyling around the age of 8, when, he tells me, he mostly rapped about drugs. But by the time he was 16, under the name K-Dot, his closest friends still call him Dot, he got serious about music. I was recording in Dave Free's garage, he tells me, and Dave said he had to get my music to Top, Anthony Top Dog Tiffith, who was getting into the music business. The first day in the vocal booth, Top said, "Let me see if this is really you." And I was just freestyling, rapping whatever came into my head, sweating for 2 hours. Dave Free said, "The first time I ever heard him rap, I had to listen back because it was so developed, super complex, and I just couldn't believe it since he was so young." After Kendrick's early EPs and mixtapes, Dave told him that it was time for him to drop the K-Dot and use his real name. And Top, now the head of TDE, who described himself then as a local street dude who was trying to change his life for the better, adds, "What impressed me was how advanced Kendrick was at 16 years old. He spoke from an adult perspective every time he touched the mic." Over the years, over the course of 15 years, I've watched him evolve from a kid on the corner breaking down street tales to a creative genius breaking down cultural barriers. Kendrick tells me that most of the kids he knew from elementary school are either dead or in jail. But, he says, he was more grounded because he had a mother and a father in the home. "It makes a huge difference," he says. "It shows you loyalty. When I look around at my classmates and my friends, they all lived with their grandparents. To have a mother and a father in your household, this showed me immediately that anything is possible." On his major label debut, Good Kid, Mad City, both his parents are heard on answering machine tapes, and their language is tough, uninhibited. His mother, after yelling at him to bring back her van, then turns tender and says, "I love you, Kendrick," and tells him to take this music thing seriously, be a positive person, and come back and tell your stories to your city. She adds that his music better be something that she and his father can step to, because we from Chicago and that's what we do. Kendrick tells me his parents were young when they left Chicago with just $500 and wound up in a Compton hotel. Mom had to go to McDonald's to get hired there. My father had to find friends, and it was a whole gang culture. They were learning, and they did the best they could do as far as protecting me. But they loved to indulge in that fast lifestyle, the partying, and everything that comes with it. My mother encouraged me to dream. She was very proud of my efforts. My third grade teacher came up to my mother once at a parent-teacher meeting, and she said, "Your son used a word that I was totally amazed by. He said audacity." Even then, it gave me an advantage in life to be able to take information, listen to it, and take a perspective without judging it and do my own research. The duality was that my father was more like, "Okay, good, now do it again." There never was a super embrace, and it gave me an understanding of being critiqued. Almost like, "I know you can do it better, so I'm not going to show you how great you are already." It was a manipulation that worked in my favor later in life. By the time I was being critiqued, there was nothing you could tell me, because I know it's not my best anyway. I asked if growing up he had read a lot of books. "I read the dictionary," he said. We talk about the violence he sings and raps about in Good Kid, Mad City, and Kendrick says, "That was our world. I remember when Good Kid came out. The people I grew up with couldn't understand how we made that translate through music. They literally cried tears of joy when they listened to it, because these are people who have been shunned out of society. But I know the kinds of hearts they have. They're great individuals. And for me to tell my story, which is their story as well, they feel that someone has compassion for us. Someone does see us further than just killers or drug dealers. We were just kids." I ask about the line that implies he shot someone at 16, and he just looks at me, smiles, and eventually says, "I'll put it this way, I've seen my own bloodshed, and I've been the cause of other people shedding their blood as well. There was a split second when I felt what my homeboys were feeling, like I don't give an F anymore, and that's when I knew something else had to happen." Among the something else in his life, two baptisms, the first at 16, and again in my 20s, just for that reassurance and belief in God. Paul Rosenberg, Eminem's manager and the chairman and CEO of Def Jam Recordings, was the first to bring Kendrick's music to Dr. Dre, who signed him to his Aftermath label in a joint deal with TDE. "Kendrick is an extremely prolific and cerebral rapper," says Rosenberg. "Every word is so well placed, so thought out, so meaningful, there's no dead space." And Dr. Dre told me, "The thing that turned me on the most was when I watched a video of him talking about his music and the passion he had in his voice about the art. You just knew this guy was destined for greatness." Producer Rick Rubin says, "Kendrick is one of the best of all time, making modern and challenging new music." He adds, "He exists on another plane." In addition to Kendrick's extraordinary talent as a writer, rapper, and producer, he has an ear for melody and an ability to assume different voices on his songs, which he tells me he got from listening to Prince and the music he heard at his parents' house parties. He also packs so many words and syllables into one bar of a song without ever stopping for breath. And through his music, he's taken on the role of spokesman for a neighborhood that goes way beyond Compton. I ask him, "Why you?" "I put that responsibility on myself. I knew from jump that I thought a little bit different. People respected me, and if I let myself down, I'd be letting my guys down." Fast forward to 2018. I'm in a position where these guys have 10, 15, 20 years in prison. But I can go in there, and I do, and tell them that when they get out, you have a job. And my word stands. I ask him about the guns in his Piro, also known as Bloods, neighborhood in Compton. And he says, "I have compassion for and more understanding rather than frustration with my homies, because I know it's not 100% their fault. When I look at how society has shaped our communities, it's been generations passed down of people, of putting people in cages to battle each other." He talks about the survivor's guilt that is a recurring theme in his songs, and says, "I had 3 or 4 years of success and celebrity, but I can't get rid of the 20 years of being with my homies and knowing what they go through. I can't throw that away. I know a lot of people who could. I've seen it, like, F you, I've got money now, I'm out of here. I don't give an F about none of y'all. But that was something I couldn't deal with. I had to sit back and analyze it and figure out other ways I could impact these people without physically trying to bring the whole hood inside a hotel." During a solo set at the Hangout Festival in Alabama this past May, Kendrick brought a white female fan on stage to sing Mad City with him, as he's done at many of his concerts. White people usually know to move the mic away from their mouths when it gets to the parts with the N-word. She didn't, and he stopped the show and called her on it. He and I discussed the ubiquitous use of that word in rap, with the A at the end of it, and the implicit understanding of who can say it and who cannot. I mentioned that many rappers have told me that they feel they have appropriated that word and taken it back. But Oprah once told Jay-Z in an interview that when she hears it, even with an A at the end, she thinks of a lynching. Kendrick is thoughtful for a long minute, then he says, "Let me put it to you in its simplest form. I've been on this earth for 30 years, and there's been so many things a Caucasian person said I couldn't do. Get good credit, buy a house in an urban city. So many things, you can't do that, whether it's from afar or close up. So if I say this is my word, let me have this one word, please let me have that word." I ask Kendrick about how he writes. "Execution is my favorite word," he says. "I spend 80% of my time thinking about how I'm going to execute. And that might be a whole year of constantly jotting down ideas, figuring out how I'm going to convey these words to a person to connect to it. What is this word that means this? How did it get here? And why did it go there? And how can I bring it back there? Then the lyrics are easy." I ask him how he delivers so many syllables and words in one line, with no wasted words and juxtapositions like Halle Berry, Hallelujah, or a play on words like Democrips and Reblugflickens, or I got power, poison, pain, and joy inside my DNA. It comes from my love of hip-hop. Eminem is probably one of the best wordsmiths ever, Kendrick says. There's a whole list of why, but just bending words. The Marshall Mathers LP changed my life. Eminem returns the compliment, saying he switches up his flow every few bars so it's more interesting to listen to. Kendrick adds, "My other favorite word is discipline. Discipline gives me all my unvarnished strength and makes me curious about how disciplined I can be." Next photo, Lamar, photographed in the Bronx. The following day, we're backstage at Madison Square Garden, prior to that night's show. Top is here, wearing a red TDE cap. SZA, the only female on the TDE label, is determined to perform, despite vocal cord problems that forced her to cancel some tour dates. She says about Kendrick, "He's really committed. He takes his natural aptitude and jacks that shit up to like 50,000. For you to be that naturally talented already and still want to be better is weird, inspiring, and beautiful." In a small room adjacent to Kendrick's larger, dimly lit dressing room, he and I talk some more. I tell him it's hard to imagine that with his skill for such rapid-fire rapping, he stuttered as a kid. And he says he got over it by just not being in fear of constantly talking to people. That's what my mother told me. He describes himself as introverted rather than shy, and says, "I like to be alone a lot. I need that. It's that duality. I can go in front of a crowd of 100,000 people and express myself, then go back, be alone, and collect my thoughts all over again." I note that after his opening set on Kanye West 2013 Yeezus tour, he seemed to have flipped a switch and was a different guy, way more energized and confident as a performer. "I think it was after my trip to South Africa," he says. "It gave me a feeling of awareness and pride, a feeling of where I belong." One of his lyrics is about how to be rich and black in America and not act a fool, he says. "We've got to get to the root of never having these things. I look back to when I was 16 years old and thought, what would I do with $1 million? I'm going to buy this, I'm going to buy that. Then I thought that me doing that is actually hurting people I'm responsible for. I'm the first in my family to have this kind of success. So I took it upon myself to wisely navigate this success, because I wanted them to be successful too. I tell him that Chuck D once told me that in the 1980s, we was broke, but we wasn't broken. And Kendrick says, I love that. I felt that for sure, because the times we had to wait for food stamps every month, or we'd run out of food and had to wait for welfare to kick in, or walk to the county building. It wasn't about the county building. It was about the walk to the building. Because if we didn't have that county building to walk to, I wouldn't have built that bond with my mother or my father to see that this is a family. What Chuck D says resonates so much with me, because we were broke, but we had us. I ask him if he wants to start a family, and he says, this is the constant question, because I'm obsessed with my craft and what I'm doing. I know what I'm chasing for my life, even though I don't know what it is, but it's an urge that's in my every day. That urge to make an ultimate connection with words to man, and I don't feel I've done that yet. We talk about the soundtrack he curated and produced for the blockbuster film Black Panther, and we discuss what's involved in an Oscar campaign. Should All the Stars, his song with SZA from that soundtrack, be nominated? That would be crazy, says SZA, about a possible Oscar nomination, but that's everything that Dot does. Kendrick says that the TDE Championship Tour, the lineup at the Garden included Sir, Absol, Isaiah Rashad, J-Rock, Schoolboy Q, SZA, and Kendrick, has always been a dream. To have our own tour, our own artist, he says, the model was Motown, Bad Boy, Rockefeller, Def Jam, Aftermath. Pulling up his long-sleeved T-shirt, he shows me the tattoo going all the way up his right forearm, Hustle Like You Broke Dollar, which he says was something Top said. Always have that mentality. Don't be lax. We talk about the NFL and the National Anthem protest. He says he was a football fan, but now I'm less enthused. It's enraging. I think what Cap, Colin Kaepernick, is doing is honest, and it's not just his truth, it's our truth. Our talk continues to cover a variety of topics. I say that even though he lives in Malibu now, and moved his family out of Compton, he's not showy. He's not rapping about bling. He says his father had jewelry. He'd seen it, and it didn't interest him. And he doesn't boast the same way a lot of rappers do. I tell him that I love that he didn't rhyme Grey Poupon with Louis Vuitton. Still, he calls himself the greatest rapper alive. And he says, I owned up to a lot of hours of just listening and studying and throwing thousands of pieces of paper away that were garbage. Hours of Top saying, nah, that ain't it. You're better than that. Or me saying, nah, that ain't shit. Are there enough hours in the day for him to do everything he wants to do? That's one of my phrases, he says. We need more hours. I look up and it's 5 in the morning, 6 in the morning, and I'm still in the studio. I need 26, 27, we good. Then at 10:15 p.m., with a backdrop that says Pulitzer Kenny, Kendrick Lamar takes the stage at the Garden for a raging 75-minute performance. Even with all of the lights, videos, lasers, and pyro, you cannot take your eyes off him as he delivers a breathtaking, joyful live set that proves he really does rap all those words without stopping for breath. A set that includes songs from his 3 major label albums, Good Kid, Mad City, To Pimp a Butterfly, and Damn, the album that won him the Pulitzer. Kendrick Lamar's work represents some of the most important music being produced today, period. He fits squarely on stage in the artistic community, like any other cutting-edge musical genius, said Dana Kennedy, administrator, the Pulitzer Prizes. Rap is the biggest music out there, and it's nice that it's finally getting the recognition it deserves. For his album to make it onto that platform is great for all of us. Oh, and I'm also jealous, said Eminem. May 30th, 2018, the Lowe Library at Columbia University in Manhattan, where the Pulitzer Prizes are handed out, isn't very hip-hop, with the exception of the table of Kendrick's friends and colleagues. The room has a cathedral-like domed ceiling and marble columns, and the vibe is academic. Previously, Toni Morrison had told me that the Pulitzer ought to shape up. Their canvas is not wide enough. It's narrow. So this means it's wider. And Pharrell told me that this is the universe winking at us. Kendrick is wearing a blue shirt with a shiny gold pattern, tan pants, and Nike Cortez Kennies. He sits at table number one with his fiancée, Whitney Alford, Dave Free, Dana Kennedy, her son, and two of his friends, Gayle King and CNN's Don Lemon. Kendrick is clearly the star of the show. Everyone is trying to take selfies with him. After the prizes are handed out, he races out with the TDE team, avoiding reporters, but stopping to take photos with kids. Then it's back into the van for the trek to Jones Beach on Long Island, where the championship tour will do another show. Backstage, Kendrick works out at his mobile gym, a pull-up bar, and weights. He does between 500 and 1,000 push-ups a day. And then he and I sit in a small room and talk about the Pulitzer Prize. It was one of those things I heard about in school, he says, but I never thought I'd be a part of it. When I heard I got it, I thought, to be recognized in an academic world, whoa, this thing really can take me above and beyond. It's one of those things that should have happened with hip-hop a long time ago. It took a long time for people to embrace us, people outside of our community, our culture, to see this not just as vocal lyrics, but to see that this is really pain, this is really hurt, this is really true stories of our lives on wax. And now, for it to get the recognition that it deserves as a true art form, that's not only great for myself, but it makes me feel good about hip-hop in general. Writers like Tupac, Jay-Z, Rakim, Eminem, Q-Tip, Big Daddy Kane, Snoop, it lets me know that people are actually listening further than I expected. When I looked up at that man on the podium today, I just had countless pictures in my mind of my mother putting me in suits to go to school. Suit and tie from the dollar store, from thrift shops, when I was a kid. He recalls his seventh grade teacher, Mr. Inge, who turned him on to poetry. It wasn't a traditional English class, he says. It was more of an artistic exercise. He told us to write something only you can understand, then pass it on to the next person. He tells me about the visit with his parents to the White House. Obama reached out. My mother wore a black and brown dress. She made sure to wear her best. And he tells me it took me back to talking to my grandma when she was alive, and I was always thinking what it would be like if we had a black president. She had some hope. And even though Kendrick has had political songs such as Triple X and All Right, which became an anthem for Black Lives Matter marches, he says he doesn't talk much about politics because I just get too frustrated. I ask him how he feels about Kanye West's statements about Trump and about slavery, and after a long pause, he says he has his own perspective, and he's on this whole agree-to-disagree thing, and I would have this conversation with him personally if I want to. I ask about his song Love on Damn, and he says that's one of my first real personal love songs. It's personal for me, but it's a universal feeling when people listen to it. But as for his own personal love relationship with Alford, he doesn't talk about it, he says, because I want something that's just for me. Since he says he was confident as a kid and he's confident now, why were there all these self-doubts he's written about that came in between? I never thought about it like that, he says. That's a question I'm going to ask myself tonight. Maybe it's that fear. A lot of artists have a fear of success. They can't handle it. Some people need drugs to escape. For me, I need the microphone. That's how I release it. And just figuring out a new life. Maybe thinking that I'm doing something wrong, or that I'm a little bit different, or gifted. It's the same thing as not wanting to accept compliments, just wanting to work harder. As for what's next, I don't know, he says, and that's the most fun part, the most beautiful part. I ask him, as he sings in Element, he would die for this shit, and he says, without a second's hesitation, I would. George Lucas Strikes Back. For 5 years, in 3 different cities, the Star Wars creator tried to build a museum for his art collection. Paul Goldberger talks to him about his struggles, setbacks, and ultimate success. Opening photo, a rendering of the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art, which broke ground in Los Angeles in March. And in a photograph by Stefan Ruiz, George Lucas and Melody Hobson at Skywalker Ranch in Marin, California. There are a number of reasons why movie directors do not generally go around establishing museums. It is not only because most of them do not own enough artworks to put into them, or have enough money to start new careers as philanthropists. If you direct movies for a living, you are accustomed to controlling just about everything that comes across your field of vision. But if you decide to build a museum, you can control very little, as George Lucas, who has plenty of art and plenty of money, has discovered over the past several years. His quest to donate more than $1 billion worth of art and architecture in the form of a brand new public museum containing the bulk of his collection of paintings, drawings, and film memorabilia was turned down in San Francisco, driven away by opponents in Chicago, proposed again for a different location in San Francisco, and finally last year approved for a site in Los Angeles. The project, which is now officially named the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art, but given its history, might just as well be called the Flying Dutchman, will take the form of a dramatic, swooping, cloud-like structure designed by the Chinese architect Ma Yansong in Exposition Park, adjacent to the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum. What Lucas is now building, ground was broken on March 14th, and there is already an excavation so large that it looks like a massive earthwork if you view it from an airliner approaching Los Angeles International Airport, could not be more different from where he started out. The museum's original incarnation, proposed for waterfront land within the Presidio National Park, with views of the Golden Gate Bridge, was a grandiose, heavy-handed Beaux-Arts building that Lucas, who prides himself on his love of both art and architecture, insisted was the only thing appropriate for that site. That first version was called the Lucas Cultural Arts Museum, a title as awkwardly semantically as the building was architecturally. Its unveiling in 2013 marked the beginning of a multi-year saga that would come to have nearly as many dramatic clashes as you'll encounter in Lucas's Star Wars, and almost none of the amiability of his American Graffiti. No one back then had the slightest idea that the proposed museum would provoke a major backlash in not one, but two American cities, or that it would finally come to rest in Los Angeles, a location that carries no small degree of irony, since it is a city that Lucas built much of his identity as a filmmaker on spurning. Although he studied film at the University of Southern California and has been a major supporter of its film school, he has lived and worked in Northern California for most of his life. And for years, he made something of a fetish of avoiding Los Angeles as much as possible. Although Lucas bought a $33.9 million estate in Bel Air last year, which will allow him to be close to the museum as it rises, he still spends most of his time either in Marin County, north of San Francisco, or in Chicago, where his wife, Melody Hobson, a Chicago native who is the president of a financial firm, Ariel Investments, is based. Chicago, of course, would become the second city to find itself the recipient of what Lucas felt to be his unrequited love. Lucas's odyssey began long before Chicago or San Francisco, however, and really goes back several decades to when he began to make money and to collect art. As with many directors, his visual sensibility extended far beyond the camera. What was curious about Lucas was that his interest in art had relatively little to do with the avant-garde. Unlike, say, Billy Wilder, Otto Preminger, and Albert Lewin, all directors who collected modern art. Still, Lucas was hardly a reactionary in his taste. He responded to a certain boldness, which is why he loved Frank Lloyd Wright. He liked both blunt California mission-style design and Victorian extravagance, and he found that he could be drawn to plenty of new art as long as it was emotionally engaging and told some sort of story. What bothered him about abstraction wasn't that it didn't look attractive, but that he felt it didn't tell a comprehensible narrative. Over the years, Lucas acquired significant holdings in Norman Rockwell, Thomas Hart Benton, Jacob Lawrence, Romare Bearden, and Maxfield Parrish, among other figurative artists, as well as vast numbers of editorial cartoons, early examples of comic strips, and posters, and other forms of graphic art. Before long, he had several thousand pieces. He now owns roughly 15,000 separate artworks, in addition to archival material from his films. He started thinking about the connections among art and illustration and filmmaking, and wanted to make something of it all. He also became a proselytizer for the notion that the kind of work he favored had been overlooked by the art establishment. Narrative art is an illegitimate child of art. You won't see it in any major museum, Lucas said to me when we talked last summer at the high-rise condominium that he, Hobson, and their young daughter share on Chicago's Gold Coast. That isn't entirely true, of course. Narrative art, which is commonly defined as the use of image to tell a story, and can include everything from prehistoric cave paintings to carvings, tapestries, and murals, as well as commercial art, editorial and political cartooning, comics, poster art, and figurative art, is found in the collections of most comprehensive museums. By most measures, you could describe a great post-impressionist painting like Seurat's A Sunday in La Grangeotte in the Art Museum of Chicago, just a few blocks down Michigan Avenue from where we were meeting, as a form of narrative art. Italian frescoes and the stained glass windows in Gothic churches are narrative art, too. So is much photography. Lucas likes to think of himself as an outsider in the world of art, much as he positions himself as an outsider in the movie industry, a director who has always gone his own way. The genesis of his museum, he said, sitting beside Hobson on a sofa beneath a Fernand Léger painting, came out of his desire to put a stake in the ground for popular art, for San Francisco, and for anthropology. The original idea was that it would tell you the history of art from cave paintings to digital art. At the same time, Lucas felt, it could be a record of Northern California's contributions to filmmaking, which included not only his own company, Lucasfilm, but more recent digital innovators such as Pixar, the company once owned by Steve Jobs. Lucas had already built an office building in 2005 for Lucasfilm. He sold the company in 2012 to Disney for just over $4 billion on the grounds of the Presidio, a former army base that had been transformed into a national park. And governed by the Presidio Trust, an organization charged with the often conflicting goals of protecting the park's landscape and encouraging economic development. Given Lucas's history at the Presidio and with San Francisco, it seemed natural to propose building his museum there, preferably on Crissy Field, a portion of the park along the waterfront. Here are some highlights from Lucas's collection. N.C. Wyeth's The Storybook, 1921. R. Crumbs, The Book of Genesis, Chapter 1, 2009. Thornton Yutz's Commuter Pickup, 1956. Romer Bearden's Scylla and Charybdis, 1977. Norman Rockwell's After the Prom, 1957. Gordon Parks, Storefront, Mobile, Alabama, 1956. Jacob Lawrence's Harlem Street Scene, 1942. Arthur Sizek's Parade of the Mighty Warriors, 1942. Thomas Hart Benton's Axes, Clearing the Land, 1924-27. Norman Rockwell's Saying Grace, 1951. Maxfield Parrish's Air Castles, 1904. Paul C. Starr's Retouching an Old Masterpiece, 1915. Enrique Alvim Correo's Martian Fighting, Machine Hit by Shell, From the War of the Worlds, 1906. A Winsor McKay editorial cartoon, New York Herald, circa 1920s. Romare Bearden's The Sea Nymph, 1977. Jesse Wilcox Smith's Little Red Riding Hood, 1911. Gordon Parks, Andrea Tanner and Her Grandmother, Window Shopping, Mobile, Alabama, 1956. Elizabeth Shippen Green's The Child in Garden, The Little Gate, 1914. Carrie Mae Weems's Untitled Kitchen Table Series, 1990. Joseph Leyendecker's Republicans vs. Democrats, 1936. I wanted to do something modern. I wanted an iconic building like the Sydney Opera House, but they said you absolutely won't put a modern building there, Lucas told me. He later explained to Charlie Rose that his intention had been to invite five prominent modern architects to produce designs and then select the one he liked best. Instead, he went to the Urban Design Group, a large Dallas-based firm with which he had worked before, and asked it to produce a traditional museum design in the manner of Bernard Maybeck's Palace of Fine Arts, a Beaux-Arts landmark on the edge of the Presidio. And that is when things began to go south. The Urban Design Group is a commercial firm whose expertise was neither designing museums nor working in traditional architectural styles. And its scheme, as the San Francisco Chronicle critic John King wrote, looked like a generic Spanish-themed shopping center. It was also 69 feet high, and design guidelines set by the Presidio Trust required that buildings be no higher than 45 feet in order to preserve views toward the Golden Gate Bridge. The Trust, not wanting to turn over public land to Lucas without giving others a chance to come up with alternative proposals, put out a general call for cultural projects and received 16 submissions, all of them no higher than 45 feet. Unwilling to compromise on the design, Lucas embarked on a public relations campaign for his museum and his vision, enlisting Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, California Governor Jerry Brown, and Senator Dianne Feinstein, among others, to endorse his proposal. Disclosure, I was asked to consult with Lucas's organization to try to find ways to improve the building's design, but nothing came of it. The campaign failed to change the opinion of some San Franciscans that the central issue was not whether to accept a gift to the community, but whether to allow a powerful figure to have his way with a cherished piece of local land. A few years earlier, opponents had defeated a plan by Don and Doris Fisher, the founders of The Gap, to build a museum for their modern art collection elsewhere in the Presidio. And some of Lucas's initial missteps gave them plenty of ammunition for another fight. He at first refused to provide many details about his collection or about the curatorial plans for the museum, which encouraged the view that the project was a rich man's indulgence. A few sentimental paintings, dressing up a showcase for Star Wars memorabilia. Lucas seemed to treat the whole approval process with a sense of disdain, verging on entitlement, made manifest in an interview he gave in September 2013 to Deborah Solomon of the New York Times, in which he complained that the Presidio Trust made us jump through hoops to explain why a museum was worth having. He concluded, "They hate us." Lucas and the Presidio Trust also differed on the matter of what constituted appropriate architecture for the Presidio. The Trust made no secret of its dislike for the stage-set nature of Lucas's building and said that something more contemporary would be preferable. Lucas said that he had been told the opposite at the outset and that he had ordered up a Beaux-Arts building for that reason. Still, when it turned out that almost everyone disliked the building, Lucas dug in and defended it vigorously, insisting that the unpopular architecture of his museum was not the problem. And then, with startling speed, he changed his mind completely. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.